Welcome back. In the discussion of longevity, could microbes be the answer? Could they be the fountain of youth? My next guest is Dr. Susan Erdman from MIT. How are you doing, Dr. Erdman?
Hi, Carl. Thanks very much for making this opportunity available. Good afternoon.
Yeah, it's a great discussion. It's a continuation of discussions we've had on this show for a long time. So let's talk about the research that your group has done, first of all. Explain the design of the study.
So what we've done is worked with mouse models as a system to look at events that might be happening in humans. And the mice make a great vehicle to do this, because there are things that aren't possible to do in human subjects that can be done in animals in ways that are humane and responsible and allow us to get tremendous insight into disease processes. So we work with mouse model systems. We challenge them with different kinds of microbes, different kinds of bacteria, usually intestinal bacteria, and then we study the sorts of things that happen to them, whether they're behavioral things, whether they're physical events, or whether there's something that we would measure in their blood or by some other mechanism.
So what kind of bacteria or microbes did you introduce that would normally be found in the gut into these mice, and what happened?
Well, the studies that we've done most recently were focusing on a category of bacteria that the audience is probably familiar with that are called probiotic organisms. And we were particularly interested in a group of organisms that were isolated originally from a human donor, and that organism is now available as a commercial off-the-product or off-the-shelf product. And we were interested in seeing whether or not this probiotic organism would have certain kinds of health effects when we introduced it to the mice.
Can you tell us its name? The strain of probiotic it is?
It's a strain of Lactobacillus reuteri that we were working with. And I want to say it's probably not the only microbe that would cause these kinds of effects, but the effects were very pronounced in the mouse subjects that we examined.
Okay. So now, did you identify that this particular microbe was already non-existent in their little bellies?
Yes, it's a great question, and we did check. And they did not previously have exposure or infection with this organism prior to the time we used them in the experiment.
So how much did, and this is something that we talk about on the show all the time, right? People take probiotics. They take a capsule. It's got 30,000 CFUs of something. And I say, you know what that's like? That's like throwing a handful of grass seed on a football field. Your body has so much of these microbes in it. And taking a little capsule like that is really insignificant. So how much did you have to give them in human terms, if you will, and what did you find?
So we were actually surprised at what a small dosage was required in order to get the effects in mice. And so in mice, it turned out to be something equivalent to 300,000 organisms a day.
Wow.
I don't know exactly what that would translate in people, but if a human is taking one of those supplements, and many of the supplements on the market, you know, are marketed with 5 billion organisms.
Right.
This was not an enormously large number of organisms. It's not entirely clear whether it's required that the organisms even be alive, but feeding that supplement, even in those small amounts, routinely to the mice created these enormous, easy to observe physical effects, and then those were things that we could also translate into different behaviors, different measurements of things from the bloodstream, and on and on.
So what were the observable effects when you did this?
Well, there were quite a few. Some of them are more interesting to the general public than others. The things that we had noticed first were that there were dramatic changes in the overall appearance or character of the mice, and that had several different facets. One of them was that the fur character of the animals changed dramatically. And
really?
So these are yes, these are situations where we're simply introducing these organisms into their drinking water. Everything else they're eating is completely normal, as a mouse would normally eat in the setting, and we're putting these organisms in the drinking water, and the differences were very dramatic. So some things happened. The fur became very smooth and sleek and shiny.
Really?
And then when we examined that histologically, which is under the microscope with some special stains, we were able to determine that there were actually very impressive changes occurring within the skin and the hair. But that was really just the beginning of it, because there were many other what we would call phenotypes or physical characteristics that emerged. some of them were the kinds of things you would just notice by looking at the animals in the cage. One of them was the animals eating the probiotic organism were much more slender and active than their counterparts.
And see, this is an important discussion, because we're learning now that the microbiome of the gut may be influencing part of the obesogenic model. It may be influencing diabetes, and a story that's going to break soon may be influencing the onset of autism. So, you know, for those out there who just don't, the microbiome of the body is probably the really most important frontier of the future of health that we are looking at right now. I think of it as the ocean. You stand at the ocean, you watch the waves break, and you enjoy the ocean from the surface, but you have no idea what's going on beneath there. And that's what's going on inside your stomach. And I say this all the time, Dr. Erdman, if you want to see the greatest example of immune function, the fact that we can eat a piece of animal flesh, it doesn't poison us, and we extract everything that's good from it and get rid of all the waste, is the most profound example of the immune system.
It is. These are things we take for granted every day about the body functioning well or functioning normally. And along those lines, Carl, part of what we became quite captivated with was the possibility that these organisms were influencing whole body health, in particular through the immune system, but also through the endocrine system, the glands that make the hormones that cause us to feel and act certain ways, that the microbes might be interfacing with these systems in our everyday lives. A process, if we understood better, might help us retain a lot of the vim, vigor, and vitality of youth as we age in ways that are constructive, because we're working with something that's very organic, something that essentially co-evolved with us over the millennia. And so if we understood this process without doing anything, for lack of a better term, artificial, we could potentially create opportunities for ourselves to feel good, have a long, healthy, meaningful life, and that sort of thing.
Well, and what I find most exciting about this is this looks to me, from the research, and we're going to talk more about it when we come out of this break, you know, there's always this discussion of, you know, what causes us to age. And when we talk about the endocrine system, there's a lot of discussion about the hypothalamic pituitary testicular axis. Well, does the pituitary give out first? Do the Leydig cells give out first? Well, no one's even thinking about the microbiome of the body. It's not even in the discussion. And that's what we're going to talk about when we come out from the other side of the break. This is a really exciting discussion. We're talking with Dr. Susan Erdman from MIT. You're not going to want to miss a second of this. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back. We're talking with Dr. Susan Erdman. We're talking about the microbiota of the gut and how it may be influencing the aging process. You know, we can sit here and talk all about the immune system. And I think we all understand the importance of the immune system and how it depends on the microbiome of the gut. But this is a different discussion. I want to kind of segue away from the immune system for a second, Dr. Erdman, okay?
Yes.
I want to go right to the endocrine system, because we understand that hormones are messengers. They tell us that we're young and thriving, or that it's time to evacuate the planet. And so this is the whole basis for HRT. You know what I mean? It's like, what if you didn't need HRT? So talk to us about that portion of the study.
Well, we were quite surprised at first, but it made a lot of sense when we put all of the pieces together about the different things that we had seen in our mouse models. So you recall from earlier that I was describing we fed them these purified microbes, we put them in the drinking water, and we started seeing dramatic changes in their behavior. And one of them was what we coined mouse swagger. And mouse swagger is this very I've got it going on mouse attitude.
Really?
That it involves a sort of a strutting around the cage, you know, presenting genitalia and these sorts of things. That
sounds like Italian guys from Brooklyn to me.
So we were amused at first, and then quite intrigued about the possibility that there may be a lot going on that that we hadn't yet examined. And so we began looking at different glandular tissues throughout the body, and also looking at the hormones that those tissues would normally produce. And as you pointed out, these are the chemical messengers. These are the things that tell us how to act, tell us what we're interested in. And the bottom line is that what we found was that there was actually a tremendous network of hormonal activity that was inspired by eating these microbes.
Man, that's amazing to me. Now, was there any increase in things like lordosis or a willingness to mate or anything like that?
So we did set up mating experiments, and it's probably too long of a story to tell in the time that we have available. But yes, the mating experiments told us that these animals were very interested in everything involving reproduction, and both the males and the females were affected.
See, and the reason this is important is this, because we've talked about, I've said on this show that libido may be the greatest indicator of where you are on the lifespan scale. Because we have one job, all organisms have one job, and that is to continue the species and then evacuate the planet. And if you still have a libido, it means your body thinks that you're still young enough to have offspring. So the fact that these mice had increased desire to reproduce means that their bodies thought, hey, everything in the environment is great, life is great, I can still have offspring.
Yeah, that's really quite insightful, because it took us quite a long time to begin to get all of those pieces together, but that was ultimately our conclusion, was that this was all about reproductive fitness. And because reproductive fitness is a big part of who we are as individuals, and particularly youthful activities, we saw this as one piece of a very significant longevity puzzle in terms of trying to optimize health and happiness and a sense of meaning. And that was the context with which we approached all of our subsequent studies. So I'm glad to answer questions about any of that.
Yeah, no, this is really, really cool. Any other hormonal markers or any other biomarkers change as it relates to where they were chronologically, age, and where they went to after they were supplemented?
Yes. There were a few that were very significant. One of them was the hormone oxytocin, and your listening audience is probably very familiar with this hormone.
Yeah.
What we found was that the microbes were actually upregulating the expression of oxytocin, and we tied it together from an evolutionary context in everything from all of the mating behaviors and mammalian social bonding to, importantly, the infant-mother bond and everything that means in terms of what we are as mammals. And so because there's an increasing body of knowledge about the many roles oxytocin has in our well-being on a lot of different levels, and the things we perceive to be meaningful in life, oxytocin, I think, is a very important piece of the hormonal puzzle in terms of trying to understand the potential of these microbes for health and wellness. So oxytocin was one very important player, and that gave us a big clue into tying the whole body mechanism together, because we began focusing very intensively on the hypothalamic pituitary axis that you emphasized earlier. And as it turns out, that axis is integrated with the gonads, or the sex organs. It's integrated with the adrenal glands, and everything we do with stress and like sodium processing and blood pressure. And it's also integrated with the thyroid. And so we went after the thyroid gland as well. In some of our more recent work, looking at the possibility that the thyroid gland activities might be regulating the things that I had described earlier, the lack of gaining body weight over time. These animals remained very slender. They were actually quite active, which is something that I think most people, as they're aging, would really prize, being thin and being active. And this is exactly what was happening to the mice. And so we examined those hormones as well. And what we found was a really interesting phenomenon, Carl, and that was the hormones were upregulated compared to their aged counterparts that were untreated, but they weren't outside of normal limits. So what it was doing was it was creating a homeostasis
or right.
A balance. So they weren't extraordinarily high. They also weren't low and dropping like their counterparts. They were right in that sweet spot of what it takes to be
youthful,
healthy, feeling good, active, and that's the essence of what we discovered. And it was not independent of the immune system, but it was certainly in addition to everything we knew about the immune system, and it turns out interactive with the immune system.
Well, I want to throw something else at you, okay? Mm-hmm. So there is a silent epidemic, but nonetheless an epidemic of snoring equals obstructive sleep apnea in this country today, in men especially. And there's a lot of evidence now from research that I've been poking around that leads me to believe that your research in the effects of healthy microbiome and physiology may actually be part of the reason for this through the vagus nerve, which is influenced by oxytocin, and the thyroid. Most people have obstructive sleep apnea or snore tend to be either subclinical or clinically hypothyroid. And I believe that what's happened to us is we've lost the diversity of microbiome in our bodies. According to the Wenner-Gren Foundation, Paleolithic human beings had like 22,000 different types of microbiota. Today we have like 2,000, I think. And I could be off on these numbers, but that's how vast the difference is. I have a funny feeling that your research is going to be influencing a lot of different modern day physiological malfunctions. Like everybody out there has arrhythmias today, right? What do they call that? Atrial fib. This is also influenced by the vagus nerve, which is influenced by the gut because of the microbiota, which is influenced through oxytocin. When I start connecting these dots in my head, I think, man, this is really the new frontier for health. Getting
it's
this right.
It's quite profound, isn't it? We've been surprised, you know, as much as we study these things day in, day out, the interconnections between them have amazing implications for potentially healthy, high-quality lives and enjoying everything we have and sharing that with subsequent generations. Figuring out how we're going to reestablish healthy microbiome, healthy immune system, healthy hormonal balance. I might have some challenges, but I think this is giving us insights that are at least pointing us in a direction, gives us a lot of clues so you know we can move forward in an effective way.
Okay, a couple real important questions before we end the interview. First of all, the little mice did not have Lactobacillus rhodi. Is that what it was called?
It's pronounced, Reuteri or Reuteri,
I
want to
write this
down. They did not have it. They did not have it prior to the time.
Do humans have that in their gut?
Some humans do. It's an excellent question. So the information that's available now suggests that those cultures, those individuals, populations that have maintained very traditional practices of vaginal births, breastfeeding, exposure to a lot of other species of animals, tend to get Lactobacillus reuteri and a lot of the other probiotic organisms established very early in their lives, and they remain part of their normal flora throughout their lifetime. We've created, and you probably talk about this all the time to this radio audience, we've created a very artificial set of conditions, some of them with very compulsive hygiene, that interrupt that process. Yeah. And so many of the individuals living in modernized societies, industrialized nations, no longer have some of these organisms that you could isolate from the bowel. So it's very much in line with what you had suggested earlier. The diversity is important, and the natural practices that for many years, humans took for granted that we've suddenly removed in the past 50 years or so because of trying to make life better have actually made it very difficult for us to interact with our microbiome in the most constructive ways.
So give me a peek on where do you go from here now that you've discovered this information?
Well, we've certainly discovered a lot of things in a very short period of time. And our hope is that we're going to set up some human trials. Some of those, the earliest phases are underway because we're interested in seeing whether or not we can replicate some of the most basic things that we've seen in mice and human subjects. And not surprisingly, we have not had a lot of difficulty finding volunteers.
I was just about to raise my hand, but you can't see me.
So we're interested in doing that. We're also interested in trying to determine how many opportunities there are potentially, at first using mouse models and then eventually translating this into humans, to intervene quite early in life, either during pregnancy or shortly after birth, in ways that would be relatively benign but would impart huge microbial benefits to someone over their lifetime and into future generations, and then potentially how much plasticity we have to rescue this in adults.
Right.
So, there are certainly microbes we can introduce that will...
But that doesn't mean it's going to change anything, depending on how far up the road you are already. That was my next question. So is there going to be a rescue approach, a therapeutic dose that can help reverse some of the aging that you experienced when you did not have this diversity in your gut any longer?
Yeah, so I think that's a question that everyone's wondering about. Some of the preliminary data from mouse models suggests that there are opportunities to do this, in particular with some of the certain probiotic organisms. There are opportunities to potentially do this, but it's not as simple as introducing them once and walking away. I think most of these will require, for someone who's already an older individual, will probably require, routine administrations, continuously eating these organisms, trying to make the most of whatever lifespan and health they have left.
Yeah, no, I agree. Reseeding the lawn, I call it.
But earlier in life is definitely better, Carl. I mean, the earlier you can get these things established, the better off you are. But I don't think it's too late for the rest of us.
I have to tell you, your research is really, really exciting. I want to thank you so much for taking time to come on the show today.
It was my pleasure. You asked some excellent questions, and I hope the audience learned a lot.
Oh, I'm sure everybody's going to go out and try to find this. I know. I wrote it down. I know I'm going to be looking for it after the show. So you bet that one. Thanks so much, Dr. Erdman.
You're welcome. So long.
Bye. All right. So great discussion. And keep this discussion in mind for a news story that's going to break tomorrow about autism and oxytocin. So just keep that in mind, okay? I want to thank Reggie Joal coming on the show from Predator Nutrition. Check out Predator Nutrition. Go to superhumanradio.com and click one of the banner ads there. Also, Todd Goodman from Consumer Labs. Check out consumerlab.com. And, of course, Dr. Susan Erdman for talking about the effects of probiotics on anti-aging. Very, very exciting. We'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening.